The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When confronting the horror that was the Holocaust, come inescapable questions of America's role. What did the United States know about the Holocaust, and how did it respond? Those are thorny and multi-layered questions. What is the U.S. in this case? Its government, with access to intelligence and foreign networks, or its citizens, who got their intelligence primarily from newspapers? The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum is calling on people to share newspaper articles for History Unfolded, U.S. Newspapers and the Holocaust. It's a crowdsourcing project gathering news from the time into a centralized database that will be compiled and turned into an exhibit in 2018. Alyssa Frankel and David Clevin both work in education and outreach for the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. They're here with us to talk about the project. Alyssa, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing. Great to be here.
And David, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
So you're asking citizens for primary source history, in this case, newspaper articles. What are you looking for?
Well, we are hoping that people all over the country, high school students, university students, lifelong learners, will delve into online databases as well as library archives, microfilm collections, and find out what's happening in their local community. We found already that we have gotten over 1,000 contributions to the site in just a handful of months, and it's really revealed interesting stories about local events, local people, and how they were interpreting what was happening in Europe.
I'd love to get into some of those in just a moment, but you have identified some particular events to guide citizen historians. What are a few of those?
So the events that we've chosen are really very much in line with what our exhibition curator, Danny Green, is hoping to put together for a larger exhibition on Americans in the Holocaust, opening at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in the spring of 2018. So some of those focus on very much what Americans were thinking and doing. So we look at, for instance, Dorothy Thompson's expulsion from Nazi Germany. We look at responses to Kristallnacht and to the boycott of Jewish-owned businesses in 1933. And then we look at a couple things that are closer to home. So looking at Japanese-American internment and the signing of the order for a draft in peacetime in 1940.
So these events are going to be reflected in local newspapers. You know, at the time, almost every American town had at least one local newspaper. Were local papers reporting on what was going on in Germany?
They were. One of the things that's been so gratifying to discover is that papers from large cities to small have been reporting very much on all kinds of events from what was going on in Germany and in the U.S. at the same time. And what we're finding is not just these community papers, papers that were just mainstream, but we're also looking and have found papers from other communities, both religious and ethnic and other language communities too, all finding ways to report on what was going on either in their towns or across the ocean.
So let's talk about some of the things that you're getting from people. You said you've seen more than 1,000 responses. Let's start with just one. You know, tell me what you've seen.
So I was just telling Alyssa before we came in here that I keep coming back to one of my favorite contributions to the site. It comes from the Freelance Star in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And it's a very simple article. It's about a sympathy service that was held by Friends of the Jews at the Presbyterian Church of Fredericksburg. And the reverend there, Reverend Lancaster, had invited people to come for a special service, and he invited one of the rabbis, Rabbi Raffaele from the Beth Ahava Synagogue in Richmond, to join them to speak about what was happening to the Jews in Germany at the time. And this was very early. This was late March of 1933, the same week that Dachau opened, only a few months after Hitler had come to power. But the reason it's one of my favorites is because it names members of the community, it names institutions in the community, and it made me wonder, well, what did Reverend Lancaster do as Nazi persecutions increased? What did Rabbi Raffaele do? Can we learn more about these communities? So far, I haven't seen other articles related to that church. I would be delighted if we saw more. But it's a great jumping off point for people to learn about their community's history and its place in a much larger global context.
Well, that is somewhat surprising to me in Fredericksburg, Virginia. I mean, I know that just from my own reading and research that there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the United States at the time. And because I was at your museum just a couple of weeks ago, I read about the floods of Jewish refugees, including a ship called the St. Louis that was full of Jewish refugees, and the U.S. would not let it dock here. Tell us what was going on sort of politically in the larger social context.
So that's another great point to bring up. One of the things that is really revealing about the articles we're getting is that there was enormous debate in the United States during this time about what to do about the refugee crisis in Europe. And there was this real disconnect between the fact that most Americans repeatedly, when they were polled, were very sympathetic to the Nazis' victims, felt that what the Nazis were doing was wrong, and then at the same time did not want to change American refugee policy or immigration policy. They preferred that other countries take the Jews. It was also a time of, as you pointed out, very heightened anti-Semitism in the United States. Many Americans held anti-Semitic attitudes. Many Americans held racist attitudes and were intolerant of other ethnic and religious groups as well. It was a time of enormous fear in the United States, of economic insecurity, and just uncertainty about America's future. We tend to forget that America was not the superpower back then that it is today. And most Americans did not want to get involved in another war in Europe. And so all of these factors come into play, and we really hope that this project will help bring to light for people around the U.S. this important context that these issues, to a certain degree, have always been issues in America. There are issues that we argued about then. There are issues that we're arguing about still today.
I'm talking to Alyssa Frankel and David Clevin. They are two of the forces behind History Unfolded, U.S. Newspapers and the Holocaust. It is a crowdsourcing project asking people to submit copies of their hometown, local newspapers, and their coverage of the Holocaust and all of the troubles that were simmering in Germany at that time. All of this information is going to be turned into an exhibit in 2018. You mentioned, David, the sympathy for the Jews and what the Nazis were doing to the Jews at the time. How well covered, how detailed was our understanding of that here in the United States?
It was both detailed and not. Alyssa's making eyes at me. I think she might be thinking of an article, are you?
So one of the things that I've been finding as I've been helping our community manager do some approvals of recent articles is that we have one power user working out of Connecticut who's been doing a lot of work on press coverage around the country on what was happening right before the boycott of Jewish-owned businesses in April of 1933. So these articles largely come from March 30th, 1933. And as I read through them, what I'm finding is you have a number of articles that are just very black and white. They're AP reporting on what Jews were saying, appealing to Hitler and Hindenburg, trying to stop the boycott. And then you have others where you find instances like the Fredericksburg example, where you have these sympathy services. You have people writing in letters to the editor and certainly editorials from newspaper boards themselves saying, this isn't right. This doesn't sound good to us. This doesn't feel good. And so you do have people appealing to the press and saying, you know, we're not liking what we're finding here in Germany, and is there a way to get involved?
So, of course, the crowdsourcing nature of a project like this makes it so interesting because citizens are involved. But what does that mean about, you know, the gathering of history? What does that kind of from the ground up level do to change our understanding of an event?
One of the things that I absolutely love about this project and the reason why I'm so thrilled to get to lead the charge on History Unfolded is that it's a project where we really need the entire country to come together and take part in doing this research in order to make it viable. A lot of the research that's been done in newspapers to this date has been done on large papers. There's been a lot of reporting on the New York Times. I think that story has been pretty well told. Mm-hmm. The Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, the large papers have been covered. But the story that hasn't been told is what was going on in local communities, what average people on the ground reading their local newspapers knew. And a lot of those papers aren't available in online archives, or they're not available outside of a local library system where you have to log in with your library card. So we're looking to people all over the country to be able to come together and do research, whether it's in online databases or in microfilm or in the back of their library, and tell us what it was that their community knew. So there are really two things that this does. One, it allows the museum to have a much better sense as to what the global history was throughout the United States, what people around the country knew and were reading. But it also allows for a much greater association, we think, between ordinary citizens, ordinary Americans today, and this history. That it wasn't a history that just happened an ocean away in 70 years ago, but it was something that affected their community right where they live now.
And it's interesting that you're getting students involved from today. I mean, do they even know what newspapers are?
So that's actually one of the great things that we found. This is one of my favorite stories. We have a user experience designer, Melanie Bender-Martin, who's been the person who also designed the look and feel of the website. And she works based on interviews with possible users. So one of the things that she found as she was going through very early drafts of the site is that when she worked with high school students, they didn't know what a headline was. They would look at a newspaper and they would say, okay, so this big headline at the top must be the header for all of the articles underneath it. And they didn't know that in physical newspapers, you have multiple headlines, multiple stories all on one page, because that's not the way they get their news today. So what she did, and Melanie comes from a news background originally, was go through and create a tutorial called How to Read Old Newspapers. And she walks people through, what is a headline? What is a subheadline? What is a byline? How do you figure out where this dog leg goes? Where does this article continue? So things that a lot of us who work daily in history and in newspapers, I think, are pretty standard. But getting to know our users and getting to know what they need led us to be able to create this resource that's really helping people, particularly high school students, to understand how to have intellectual access to these papers.
I saw some of these posted online, but are you posting them as they come in?
We are. We have an incredible community manager, Eric Schmaltz, whose job it is not only to help to manage the community and make sure that they're all happy and feel well cared for, but also to go through every single one of those submissions. So he's been through the vast majority of the 1,500 submissions that we've gotten and the 1,000 that we've approved. And what he does is go through and look at the thumbnails that we receive from each of these papers and see if everything checks out. Is the date that was submitted correct? Did the person put down the right headline? And once he goes through and makes sure that all of that checks out, then he publishes the article. And that's when it goes into our online database, which is searchable immediately on the site. And it goes into the map that we have on the homepage that keeps charting how many articles we have from each state.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. How much did Americans know about what was really happening under the Nazis? Well, that's a question that the History Unfolded Project aims to answer by crowdsourcing contemporary news reports from papers across America. I'm joined by Alyssa Frankel and David Clevin from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Alyssa, I think it was you that mentioned that there was broad coverage of what was going on in Germany in the bigger papers. And I did read something the Washington Post did on the Nuremberg Laws, for example. But then you got submissions from these smaller papers, like the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. There's a story there about Hermann Neugass. He's a Jewish sprinter from Tulane, and he refused to participate in what he called the Nazi Olympics of 1936, the same games where Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals. So a local newspaper covered that and also suggests that maybe Americans knew a lot more about what was going on in Germany than we've been willing to admit.
So you've touched on one of my other favorites. You're doing a great job hitting them. The story of Hermann Neugass was one that I had actually wanted that article so badly. I knew that as a young athlete, Neugass had chosen to boycott the Olympics, and it was a private decision of his. And in fact, he wasn't planning on going to the press, but there were others who had leaked stories saying that he was supporting going, and he felt he had no choice. And I knew that this existed. And I had also recently met a woman who was associated, I believe, with Tulane University. And she was very interested in the project. So we shot her an email, said, hey, can you help us find this? And within a day, she had posted it to the site. And I was delighted. Neugass's story is a very interesting one, especially as we're entering an Olympic year this year. He had equaled the world record in the 100-yard dash. Both he and Jesse Owens had equaled that record that year. And so I've always wondered about him. You know, we all know Jesse Owens' name now, but no one knows Hermann Neugass. Hmm. And it was because he made a very principled stand in this case. So thank you for bringing that up.
Well, that article and everything that you're talking about suggests to me that there was a lot more knowledge in the U.S. of what was simmering in Germany at the time, not just the actions and programs against the Jews, but even some hints of the Final Solution. So knowing that Americans really did have access to a lot of that information, can we really give them a pass?
There are ways in which that statement's both true and false. You see, or at least we're seeing, a lot of reporting, especially around major events like the anti-Jewish riots known as Kristallnacht. There was a lot reported when Rabbi Stephen Wise broke the story of the Nazi plans for the Final Solution and the fact that they intended to kill all the Jews of Europe. And there was even quite a bit reported when the War Refugee Board released a report to the press in November of 1944, again about the Final Solution and about how many Jews had been killed. The thing is that there's a difference between information being available and people really absorbing its meaning and also having the will to act upon it. As we've seen in our current day, a lot of information can be available about horrible things happening around the world, and people still oftentimes either don't know what tools they have at their disposal to respond, or simply don't have the will to respond, or have other important pressing priorities that simply are taking up their attention. In the case of the Holocaust, this was no different. The U.S. government did have relatively good information about what was going on relatively early. The American public had information through the press. Sometimes it mentioned Jews, sometimes, many times, it downplayed the persecution of the Jews in relation to Nazi persecutions in general. But a lot of times it very explicitly said that hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of people had been killed, were being killed. As I stated earlier, there were a lot of things on Americans' minds during this time, not the least of which was winning a war once the war had begun. And that does create a tension between wanting to help people who are suffering, but not being necessarily dedicated to helping them yourself.
Well, you raise the question of how much access we have now to information. You know, you don't need to roll out microfilm to find crimes against humanity now or a refugee crisis going on right now. Secretary of State charging Daesh or ISIS with genocide against Yazidis, Christians, and Shia Muslims. So this question of never again, is there a teachable moment here for us to consider the kind of news we're getting and getting on those things that preoccupy us, as you mentioned, in our daily life?
What I would like users of this project to take forward is a lesson about freedom of the press and free speech, and our rights and responsibilities in a democracy, that we have this incredible gift in the United States that is a free press, as well as the ability to speak freely through any number of media. And if we have freedom of the press and we have this wealth, this incredible banquet of information at our fingertips, then I would like to hope that many of our users and certainly other people around the country will take away that if we have all of this information, then we also have the ability to speak on it. So when you have these two rights at your hands, then there is a charge to be able to go and say, here is a thing that I have read, and I will use my powers when so many people around the world don't have this power of free speech, to be able to go and say, here is something that is happening, here is how we must act on this. And so I think it's not something that we just bury in history and say, oh, well, this is what we should have done. We have this moment right now where it's not a matter of what you would have done, but what will you do in this moment where you have situations that are similar? So how will you take all of your rights and all of your freedoms and really put them towards the freeing of other people around the world?
I would add to what Alyssa said that for those who do want to take action, that the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum does include a Center for the Prevention of Genocide. And we do play a role in trying to move leaders in America, Congress, the president, toward taking action. So you do have an ally in the institution. You can provide reliable, authoritative information on our website, not just about the Holocaust, but about contemporary issues. And you don't have to do it alone.
Alyssa Frankel and David Clevin, they are two of the driving forces behind History Unfolded, U.S. Newspapers and the Holocaust. It is a crowdsourcing project centered at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And Alyssa Frankel, Digital Projects Coordinator, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
David Clevin, Education Manager, thank you for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And you can see the History Unfolded project in progress and add a clip from your own local newspaper. All of the links are at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Art is the fruit of creativity and toil by an artist. So what happens when an artist suffers a life-threatening brain injury? In this next piece, producer Tobin Lowe brings us the story of a composer whose unusual career reveals a lot about inspiration, creativity, and the brain.
You've probably never heard of Viserion Shebelin, and chances are you've never heard his music either. When he died in 1963, his work basically died with him. And that's partly because, as a composer, he was pretty by the book.
He would be the perfect composer to use in a music theory class as an example of structure. In that sense, he wasn't actually a very imaginative composer.
This is Meta Weiss. She's a cellist and a professor who has thought a lot about Shebelin's music. Here she is singing one of his early string quartets.
Dun da da dun dun da da dun da 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 dun da 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 da.
Pretty, but forgettable, right? And this is the kind of stuff Shebelin was writing for a good part of his career. But then something changed.
I'm going to sing you the opening of the Ninth Quartet because I know it, because I played it and studied it. But like this, nobody else would be able to do this probably unless they were a freak like me. Ba da 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 da.
What you're hearing is an example of a specific point in Shebelin's life when he suddenly started writing very different music. And it goes beyond a composer playing with style or trying new tricks. His music transforms. If you were to think of him as a poet, it's like his early works are all sonnets. But his later stuff?
Let's say we can classify it as a sonnet based on its structure. But, like, if you were to read it, it would just be gibberish.
To understand what happened to Shebelin, you should know he lived in a time when it was not easy to be a composer. Born in Siberia, he made his career in Soviet-era Russia. That meant there were a lot of restrictions on what kind of music you could write. But people around him found ways to break the rules, like his friend and colleague Dmitri Shostakovich.
They were sort of like frenemies. So they tried to challenge each other with their compositions and try and one-up each other on who could be better.
And in a lot of ways, that friendly rivalry was fueled by their differences. Shebelin was a modest man and considered himself a student of other composers. Shostakovich was a self-promoter. He wrote sarcastic, edgy music in his own style. It's that rebelliousness that got Shostakovich in trouble with the Soviet regime. He was accused of being unpatriotic. Shebelin stood up for his friend and paid the price.
You know, nobody wanted to give him work, and people didn't really want to touch him because they were afraid that being associated with him was going to be bad for their careers and also potentially put their lives in danger.
For Shebelin, it was all incredibly stressful. As someone who considered himself a patriot, it was devastating. He was fired from his position as head of the Moscow Conservatory. He developed hypertension. And then, as if it couldn't get worse...
So his first stroke was September 14th, 1953, and he recovered after a few weeks.
But then, 6 years later...
The second stroke was in 1959, on October 9th, and that was the really serious one.
That second stroke was catastrophic for Shebelin, because afterwards... he went silent.
His language became pretty telegraphic, you know, just short utterances of a couple of words.
This is Dr. Anirudh Patel. He's a professor of psychology.
So imagine if you were, you know, only able to communicate with one or two words at a time.
Patel has a special interest in Shebeline. He spent years thinking about how music and language travel through the brain. He says for a long time, researchers thought the two didn't interact.
Certainly no one would ever confuse music and language, especially if you're talking about instrumental music, which doesn't have words. They sound different. They fulfill different functions in human life. You can come up with a long list of differences between them.
But Dr. Patel sees it differently. In fact, he's worked for years to prove that music and language do overlap in the brain, and he has the research to prove it. Even so, what about Shebeline?
In Shebeline's case, you have somebody who has a stroke who severely impacts their ability to speak and communicate with words and understand words, but who still is composing, you know, quite complex music.
But it turned out nobody had ever really taken a detailed look at what he was writing before and after the strokes. So that's what Meta Weiss did. She was a doctoral student at Juilliard, and she knew she wanted to look into music and the brain. Shebeline was the perfect case study. It took a couple years, but when she finally connected her musical analysis with Shebeline's physical ailments, it clicked.
And I remember just throwing like all the paper on the floor, being like, this is insane! I can't believe that this is happening right now. Like, I totally understand this all of a sudden.
What she was seeing was that even though he kept writing music, the content had changed. His understanding of the rules of harmony was gone, kind of in the same way he had lost his ability to construct a sentence. To understand what's going on here, you have to think about checkers and chess.
Those are two different sets of knowledge bases, right? They have different pieces, they do different things, they move in different ways, you play with different strategies, there are different rules.
But when you actually go to play?
Are you really using completely separate brain mechanisms to play those two games? Well, probably not. I mean, even though the rules of the game are different, there are some commonalities.
Same goes for music and language. Two completely different sets of knowledge.
But there are points at which they do intersect, and some of those intersection points are rather surprising and not obvious at first glance.
Dr. Patel studies those intersection points, one of them being syntax. That means grammar for language and harmony when it comes to music. What Meta found is compelling evidence of that overlap of grammar and harmony, because Shebeline lost both. It's hard to confirm what exactly caused the abrupt change in his music, but you can't deny that a lot happened in Shebeline's life. He was close friends with one of the greatest Russian composers who ever lived. He was politically ostracized, survived two strokes, completely lost the ability to speak, and he still kept writing music. And in spite of all that, his life remains kind of a footnote.
And you don't ever hear in either neuroscience textbooks or music history articles about the interaction of his medical condition and his music.
And that might be because on paper, Shebeline's kind of boring. To musicians, he wrote music that was just kind of okay. And for years, neuroscientists considered him a pretty open and shut case for how our brains work. And yet,
that intersection of science and the arts is kind of a new thing. And so recognizing that, you know, he was a complete person, like he wasn't just a composer, he wasn't just a brain. That's never something I think that people have wanted to explore before.
It's the whole picture between his musical output and the extraordinary circumstances of his life. All that put together makes Shebeline someone worth listening to.
What happens in one's brain is not cut off from what's happening in one's personal life or what's happening in one's political life. And, you know, all these things come together to produce, you know, what you become and who you are.
I'm Tobin Lowe.
That story was part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Make yourself a super reading machine with the Speed Reading Hand Video Program. Learn to read 3 to 5 times faster with better comprehension. The Speed Reading Hand Video comes complete with a powerful study guide. Order now and receive free the audio tape, Super Memory Power, and Mastering Concentration. All this for only $39.
Being able to read 3 to 5 times faster than normal sounds pretty amazing, right? Companies claiming to train people to read faster with no loss of comprehension or even increased comprehension have been around for decades, as have proponents of the technique. President John Kennedy claimed to be able to read 1,200 words a minute. President Carter took a speed reading course while at the White House. And as more of our daily reading has moved to the digital format, so have the tools. Now there are dozens of apps that promise to get users to read faster. Simon Oxenham covers the best and worst from the world of psychology and neuroscience, and we found his article dispelling the myth of speed reading at the Kernel. Simon, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello.
So, speed reading is a myth? Really?
So the study came out earlier this year, which looked at the way our eyes work and the way that we read. And what it suggests really clashes with a lot of the claims speed readers have for ways that they say they can speed up our reading.
Now, when they say, speed readers say, you can, we'll help you read fast, how fast is fast?
Well, your average college educated adult reads about 400 words per minute, the faster readers out there. Speed readers who have courses on speed reading will often claim that they can double that to about 800 words per minute. But there's some speed readers out there who claim that they can read way, way faster than that. There's one guy called Howard Berg who claims he can read 25,000 words per minute, which is 80 pages of text every minute.
Right, he's in the Guinness World Book of Records, I saw.
That's right. However, back when he was in the Guinness Book of Records in 1990, they didn't actually check to verify those claims. So it seems that the number that he came up with was pulled out of thin air.
Well, it sounds like the old Woody Allen joke, right? That he took a speed reading course and read War and Peace, and it was about Russia.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, what are some of the techniques that speed reading courses or apps claim will help people speed read?
Okay, so for the courses, a lot of them will claim that you can zigzag down one page and up the other. And that really clashes with what we know about how our eye works, which suggests that we can see with clarity something about the size of our own thumb held at arm's length. And obviously that's very, very much smaller than a whole page of text. There's a very big difference between reading all the words on a page and comprehending them and scanning a few of those words to get the gist of what the work is about.
And I understand that there are actually competitions, speed reading champions, to determine how fast people read things. What kind of things are they able to do?
Yeah, this is something that really interested me. Wherever you read about speed reading, whether it's The Guardian, whether it's the New York Times, a lot of these big name outlets will cite certain people, for example, Howard, having records for speed reading. But when you actually look for the competitions, the websites and the information on these competitions is extremely vague. So, for example, one of the world's speed reading champions, Anne Jones, got that title in the World Speed Reading Championship. But when I actually looked at the website, only one other person has won that championship. And the World Speed Reading Championship is now defunct. It doesn't exist anymore.
So she, Anne Jones, allegedly devoured J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Deadly Hallows in 47 minutes. I guess she didn't have a lot of competition.
Right. And the one other person that won that competition, Bethan Ruddock, actually saw my website and tweeted me, and she said that she agreed wholeheartedly with my article and that it's completely right. She didn't use any special techniques to win that competition, and her reading speed for winning the competition was only 800 words a minute, which is within the realms of what most people might be able to read.
So what's surprising to me is that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, got involved in contesting speed readers' claims. When and why did the FTC get into this?
I believe the FTC got involved because Berg, who was claiming to read 25,000 words per minute, was marketing speed reading courses. And those claims that he was making really seemed very out of kilter with the research that's been done.
So they've been working on this since 1998?
Yeah, these things have been going on for a long time. Speed reading claims aren't new, and neither are the debunkings of them. But they seem to be one of those claims that doesn't seem to go away, no matter how much research gets done.
I have to say, in my line of work, I read a lot. And I feel like I actually read slowly in order to really process stuff. I want to believe that speed reading is real. I want to believe it's attainable. But can a person actually be trained to read faster?
It's quite possible that you can be trained to read faster. Whether the techniques that are alleged to help you read faster isn't something that seems to have been scientifically proven.
Simon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Simon Oxenham, he writes about Science for Nature, Scientific American, and The Guardian, among other publications. We found his article, The Harsh Truth About Speed Reading at the Colonel. You'll find a link to read it for yourself at whatever pace you wish at wordofmouthradio.org. Google and other companies are betting that self-driving cars will fill the roads of the future. They will be safer, they argue, more efficient, and you can catch up on Game of Thrones during your commute. But a new study reveals that proving the safety of self-driving cars will not be easy, at least not without putting them on the road in huge numbers. Nidhi Kalra is senior information scientist at the RAND Corporation and director of the Center for Decision-Making Under Uncertainty. We reached her via Skype. Nidhi, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So this idea that self-driving cars will be safer does make sense, right? They won't make the same mistakes that human drivers make.
That's right. Upwards of 90% of all crashes are caused by human error. Things like fatigue, distracted driving, drunk driving. Autonomous vehicles, driverless cars, they won't make those kinds of mistakes. So there's a lot of reason to believe that they could be safer than fairly faulty human drivers.
So your organization looked at self-driving cars from the perspective of how to test their safety. So far, what are companies doing to test safety for these vehicles?
You know, a lot of work has been put into putting them on the roads in a test driving capacity to find out how they perform, how many miles can they drive without a crash, without injury. So far, there's been no fatality. They're also, you know, doing checks on the systems, some simulation modeling. But test driving is really the ultimate way to figure out if the vehicles are safe because there's just so many driving situations that they'll need to be in.
The test drives then thus far have not been in, let's say, quote unquote, the real world.
There's always been a human driver behind the wheel, but they are, in fact, on our public roads already. But they're operated, again, by trained test drivers who are ready to jump in case there's any sign that the vehicle might do something dangerous.
So your idea is that we'd have to have real data on how safe these cars are. So what would you consider? How many miles would have to be driven? How many cars would have to be on the road empirically to know that self-driving cars are safer? What did you find?
Well, let me clarify the question first. We are not saying this is the only way, but since it's the way, this sort of test driving and doing head-to-head comparisons between autonomous vehicles and human drivers, that's sort of the leading idea right now. We said, well, how many miles of driving would it take to make statistically significant comparisons if that's the route we were to go? And in the most optimistic case, let's say we're concerned with fatalities, to demonstrate with 95% confidence that the failure rate of an autonomous vehicle is at most one fatality per 100 million miles, which is the fatality rate of human drivers, you'd have to drive them 275 million miles without a fatality. It goes upwards from there into the billions of miles, depending on the kind of statistical comparison we want to make.
So billions of miles. How do you know it will take that many miles or so long to prove the safety of self-driving cars?
Well, it's a great question. It's a statistical question. We're basically asking how large does our sample size need to be? If you can sort of think back to your maybe stats 101, if you gather some data and try to make inferences about it, the smaller your sample size, the more your uncertainty. So what we asked is, well, how large would our sample size need to be? And in this case, the sample size is the miles that would need to be driven so that we're 95% confident about the results. And that's what's important, is how confident can you be about the results? If you want to be quite confident about the performance of autonomous vehicles, then they're going to have to be driven a whole heck of a lot, to the point where it's impractical if we want to prove their safety prior to letting them out on the roads. Because right now, the fleets that developers have are on the order of 10, 15, 20, 50 vehicles maybe, not even 100. And so driving, for example, 275 million miles with a fleet of 100 vehicles going 24/7 would take over a decade.
This is a question that has to arise with any new innovation, though, doesn't it? I mean, if we were testing regular, normal cars driven by human beings right now, can we assume that we'd have to do that kind of testing? I mean, should this prevent us from ever adopting the self-driving new technology?
And that's the big question. It's really, what do we do with this information? Some would say, well, we can never have autonomous vehicles, but that's not how we believe this information should be interpreted. Instead, it says, okay, it means that we may need to find different ways of demonstrating their performance, but we may also need to learn to live with a little uncertainty. And if you think back to when cars were first invented, they were not put through a rigorous statistical analysis. It was sort of, well, they look like they work. They've been tested in some conditions. They seem to work. Let's put them on the roads and see what happens. And people started driving them around. And then, for example, we discovered that many years down the line that crashes occur and something needs to be done. Then we put in seatbelts, and then decades later, airbags. So vehicles are not put through the paces like this generally, but the components are. For example, if you want to put in a new kind of airbag, there are very specific testing guidelines. And that's different because, for example, with an airbag, you can know what kinds of conditions it needs to be deployed in. You can do accelerated testing in the laboratory.
Well, short of 24/7 driving for a decade, what are some of these other methods that you're proposing?
Well, we're suggesting that there might be room for modeling and simulation in test, in vehicle simulators. There might need to be actually pilot studies, which put vehicles in the hands of consumers in very controlled settings so that we can actually start getting some of those miles under the belt and start learning from experiences, but again, in controlled settings so that the effects are contained.
Nidhi Kalra, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Nidhi Kalra, senior information scientist at the RAND Corporation and director of the Center for Decision Making Under Uncertainty. You can read more about her study on how many miles it would take to accurately assess the safety of self-driving cars for the RAND Corporation. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for listening today. There's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, also on our Facebook page or on Twitter. And don't forget, you can listen to the show on your own schedule with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth, NHPR, in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. It'll help others find it when shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.